switches to the flames. Bless the missiles, the bombs and flames. We're off to war in the Christian way, and they're doing it in your name. I stand and fight, but not alone. The people just don't want to know. I'll ease the pain.
Do you happen to know what the defense budget was for 1982?
$700 million a day. Excuse me, but I got to go.
I'd like to call my daughter in Dar es Salaam. Yeah. Do you happen to know what time it is in Tanzania?
12 hours later than it is here. That woman is crazy. I'll see you later, ma'am.
It seems like you already know where back there we are.
What good is knowledge or the facts?
If you know.
Thank you to the San Francisco Mime Troupe once again for introducing part two of the interview with Michael Canfield, the famous investigative journalist who is head and shoulders above every single investigator in the world on the Kennedy assassination. In fact, he stands head and shoulders above Oliver Stone, Jim Garrison, Mark Lane, Paul Kangas, Robert Groden. There is nobody in the history of the investigation into who killed John Kennedy that stands as high in the esteem of the serious investigators in the United States. Every single serious investigator into the ambush of President Kennedy by the CIA agrees that Michael Canfield is the greatest investigator in the history of the United States on this subject. He put together the material showing the Watergate burglars, Hunt and Sturgis, were the actual trigger men. So, we'll get back into Michael Canfield, but first, a little bit of wit from President Kennedy.
Mr. President, the Democratic platform in which you ran for election promises to work for equal rights for women, including equal pay, to wipe out job opportunity discriminations. Now, you have made efforts on behalf of others. What have you done for the women according to the promises of the platform?
Well, I'm sure we haven't done enough, and I must say I am a strong believer in equal pay for equal work, and I think that we ought to do better than we're doing, and I'm glad that you reminded me of it, Mr. President.
You have said, and I think more than once, that heads of government should not go to the summit to negotiate agreements, but only to approve agreements negotiated at a lower level. Now it's being said and written that you're going to eat those words and go to a summit without any agreement at a lower level. Has your position changed, sir?
Well, I'm going to have a dinner for all the people who've written it, and we'll see who eats what.
Mr. President, there have been published reports that some high-placed Republican people have been making overtures to your Secretary of Defense for him to be their 1968 candidate for president. Mr. President, if you thought that Mr. McNamara were seriously considering these overtures, Would you continue him in your cabinet?
I have too high regard for him to launch his candidacy right now.
Mr. President, in the 1960 campaign, you used to say that it was time for America to get moving again. Do you think it is moving? And if so, how and where? The reason I ask you the question, Mr. President, is that the Republican National Committee recently adopted a resolution saying you were pretty much of a failure.
I'm sure it was passed unanimously.
Senator Case has proposed that a watchdog committee be created to look at, into these...
To watch the congressmen and senators? Well, that'd be fine if they feel that they do that.
Mr. President, the Democratic platform in which you ran for election promises to work for equal rights for women, including equal pay, to wipe out job opportunity discriminations. Now, you have made efforts on behalf of others. What have you done for the women according to the promises of the platform?
Well, I'm sure we haven't done enough, and... I must say I am a strong believer in equal pay for equal work, and I think that we ought to do better than we're doing, and I'm glad that you...
All right. This is Paul Kangas again, your host on Reality Sandwich. I want to mention the five other things that Kennedy did for the United States and the five reasons he was killed. One is he arrested the CIA. He had the FBI arrest the CIA when they attempted a third invasion of Cuba, and he fired Allen Dulles, the head of the CIA, and he fired Eleanor Dulles, the secret number two person in charge of the CIA. Eleanor Dulles, you didn't know it was a woman, was the number two person in charge of the CIA. Well, that's still a state secret. Shh, don't tell anybody you heard that. We're not supposed to say that in public. Another thing Kennedy did was he, you may not believe this, but he actually took away the oil company's oil depletion allowance, took away the oil company's allowance, and required the oil companies to pay taxes on the oil they were selling back in 1963. Isn't that terrible? Okay, that's number two. Number three thing he did is ordered to withdraw all U.S. military personnel, including the CIA, out of Vietnam. He cut off the air cover for the invasion of Cuba. And the fifth most secret thing that he did, with secret, it was no secret that he did it. What's secret is the press in this country will not mention a single word of one of the orders President Kennedy issued, Presidential Order 111.01, which canceled the Federal Reserve contract for the printing of U.S. money. When Kennedy discovered that the Federal Reserve is a London-based British banking system that controls the United States currency, he immediately canceled their contract, cut them off, and had the U.S. government print the money from then on. Immediately after Kennedy's assassination, Johnson canceled that order. Well, correction, he didn't actually cancel the order. He simply stopped the government presses from printing the U.S. money and gave the printing job back to the British banks in London, known as the Federal Reserve. Those are the five things Kennedy did that got himself killed. And now back to the interview with Michael Canfield, the famous investigative journalist who spoke in San Francisco last week.
I've asked literally thousands of people where they were when they heard Kennedy was shot. How many people here can remember exactly where they were when Kennedy was shot? Okay, so now it's 2075. There are only five people that I've ever talked to, and some that I've read, that don't know where they were November 22, 1963. Now, I approached E. Howard Hunt at the Watergate cover-up trial, and I'm really sad that I was not able to record this, because this is one of the funniest, most interesting things that ever happened to me in my entire life. There was a gag order on it, and you could not take any recording equipment into the actual courthouse. So I had to check my cameras and recorders at the door, and I went in, and they were on a break, and he walked out and was standing talking to his lawyers when I approached him, and I said, "Mr. Hunt, I'd like to ask you some questions." And he kind of smiled at me, and he thought I was a groupie, you know, and he kind of put his shoulders back, and he said, "Well, son, I can't answer any questions because they have a gag order on me because of the case." And I said, well, Mr. Hunt, the questions I have are not about this case. And he went, oh? And I went, yes. I said, I'd like to know where you were November 22, 1963. And his face fell. He gave a shriek and ran down the hall as fast as he could, leaving me with his two lawyers standing there like going, hello. And he dove around a corner and jumped in an elevator. And William O. Bittman, who was his lawyer at the time, was standing there, and when Hunt ran, I mean, he ran like O.J. Simpson, after giving a shriek. And I thought, I was prepared for, you know, James Bond response, Hunt, E. Howard Hunt, you know, because this is the most famous spy America has, right? And the guy shrieks and runs down the hall, and William O. Bittman looks at me and says, what did you say to him? I said, I just asked him where he was November 22, 1963.
And with that bit of humor, we conclude the interview with the famous investigative journalist, Michael Canfield. And wasn't that great? All he did was ask E. Howard Hunt, the famous CIA agent, where he was the day Kennedy was killed, and the famous CIA agent had a minor heart attack and had to run to the men's room to empty his diaper. Well, okay. With that, I'm now going to give you a radio program, a historical radio program, in which Kennedy is debating Nixon. And this is the introduction to the debate between Kennedy and Nixon. But first, I have to remind you that Gene Hill, the famous eyewitness to the actual assassination ambush of John Kennedy, will be speaking in San Francisco September 6, 1992 at Fort Mason, 11 a.m. Sunday, Labor Day. For ticket information, please call our office in 415-897-0153. And speakers will be not only Gene Hill, who's written a new book called The Last Dissenting Witness, with an introduction by Oliver Stone. By the way, Gene Hill was a consultant on the movie JFK to Oliver Stone. Also speaking at it will be yours truly, Paul Kangas, a former bodyguard for President Kennedy, Hal Verb, the first person to show the Zapruder film in the United States, and Jim Licavilli, an author with a new book on the Kennedy assassination, showing the connections between George Bush and Richard Nixon to the ambush assassination of John Kennedy in Dallas, Texas. And with that, let's now go to the Nixon-Kennedy debates.
A portrait of a man gifted with the ability to make people laugh at himself and at themselves. A picture of a president who had wit and style as few in public life ever had before. This is the Kennedy wit, and we begin with the 1960 campaign. Usually, a presidential candidate avoids appearing with his opponent in the same place at the same time. But during the 1960 campaign, candidates Kennedy and Nixon did appear together. They both accepted an invitation from New York's Cardinal Spellman to address the Alfred E. Smith Memorial Dinner at the Waldorf Astoria. In listening to this speech, you'll recall two facts from the 1960 campaign. One was the coolness between Nixon and Rockefeller, and the other was a statement made by former President Harry Truman that, as far as he was concerned, he knew exactly where all the Republicans could go. In one of the Nixon-Kennedy television debates, Nixon criticized Truman's choice of language. With that background, here's Kennedy as he spoke in New York in October 1960.
Your Eminence, Cardinal Spellman, Silva, Vice President, Governor Rockefeller, Mayor Wagner, Mrs. Warner, members of the Senate, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, fellow voters. I am glad to be here. I'm glad to be here at this notable dinner once again, and I'm glad that Mr. Nixon is here also. Now that Cardinal Spellman has demonstrated the proper spirit, I assume that shortly I will be invited to a Quaker dinner honoring Herbert Hoover. Cardinal Spellman is the only man so widely respected in American politics that he could bring together amicably at the same banquet table for the first time in this campaign two political leaders who are increasingly apprehensive about the November election, who have long eyed each other suspiciously, and who have disagreed so strongly, both publicly and privately, Vice President Nixon and Governor Rockefeller. Mr. Nixon, like the rest of us, has had his troubles in this campaign. At one point, even the Wall Street Journal was criticizing his tactics. That's like the Observatore Romano criticizing the Pope. But I think the worst news for the Republicans this week was that Casey Stengel had been fired. It just shows that trapped experience doesn't count. On this matter of experience, I had announced earlier this year that if successful, I would not consider campaign contributions as a substitute for experience in appointing ambassadors. Ever since I made that statement, I haven't received one single cent from my father. One of the inspiring notes that was struck in the last debate was struck by the Vice President in his very moving statement, warning the children of the nation against, and the candidates against the use of profanity by presidents and ex-presidents when they're on the stump. And I know, after 14 years in the Congress with the Vice President, that he was very sincere in his views about the use of profanity. But I am told that a prominent Republican said to him yesterday in Jacksonville, Florida, "Mr. Vice President, that was a damn fine speech." And the Vice President said, "I appreciate the compliment, but not the language." And the Republican went on, "Yes, sir, I liked it so much that I contributed $1,000 to your campaign." And Mr. Nixon replied, "The hell you say." However, I would not want to give the impression that I'm taking former President Truman's use of language lightly. I have sent him the following wire. "Dear Mr. President, I have noted with interest your suggestion as to where those who vote for my opponent should go. While I understand and sympathize with your deep motivation, I think it is important that our side try to refrain from raising the religious issue."
When the Democrats met in Los Angeles for their 1960 convention, Kennedy's strongest opponent for the nomination was Lyndon Johnson. When Hubert Humphrey withdrew from the race after his defeat in West Virginia, sentiment for Johnson, especially in the South, began to grow. What you will hear now are Mr. Kennedy's remarks before a joint meeting of the Texas and Massachusetts delegations assembled to hear the views of the two leading candidates, Kennedy and Johnson.
"I'm glad we're not going to put these speeches to a vote after looking at Massachusetts and at the Texas delegates today. Let me just say that I appreciate what Senator Johnson had to say. He made some general references to perhaps the shortcomings of other presidential candidates, but as he was not specific, I assume he was talking about some of the other candidates and not about me. I have found it extremely beneficial serving in the Senate with Senator Johnson as leader. I think if I emerge successfully in this convention, it will be the result of watching Senator Johnson proceed around the Senate for the last 8 years. I have learned the lesson well, Lyndon, and I hope it may benefit me in the next 24 hours. It is true that Senator Johnson made a wonderful record in answering those quorum calls, and I want to commend him for it. I was not present on all those occasions. No one I was not majority leader. I, as Linda knows, I never criticized. In fact, on every occasion, I said that I thought Senator Johnson should not enter the primaries, that his proper responsibility was as majority leader, and that if he would let Hubert Wayne and I settle this matter, we could come to a clear-cut decision.
The liberal.
With that, wit from Kennedy, now let's hark back to California, 1945, 1946, and reminisce for a minute to a man named Jerry Voorhees, whose main interest, who talked frequently on radio and in the newspapers about a problem he foresaw. He even wrote a book about it. If you'd like a copy of the book, contact me and I'll get you a copy of the book. It's a book called Out of Debt, Out of Danger, and it's about how the Federal Reserve System was ripping off the United States back in the 1940s, how the Federal Reserve was printing money and distributing it in the United States in violation of the Constitution, how the Federal Reserve was printing money and charging an interest for the money that was circulating in the United States and ripping the United States off to the tune of $100 billion a year. That was in the 40s. And then Voorhees' book became quite widespread. And a man on the Senate Banking Committee decided he didn't like Congressman Voorhees' opinions and decided to get rid of Jerry Voorhees from California. So this man on the banking committee, a man named Prescott Bush, ran an ad in a Los Angeles newspaper soliciting candidates to run for the Republican seat against Jerry Voorhees. Several used car salesmen answered the ad. Several pawn shop operators answered the ad. Several disbarred attorneys answered the ad. Several snake oil salesmen answered the ad, and also a man named Richard Nixon, an attorney who had not yet been disbarred, answered the ad. Well, all the candidates strutted their stuff in front of the Prescott Bush committee, and then Prescott Bush selected Richard Nixon to represent the Bush faction to get rid of Jerry Voorhees, and they funded him very nicely and ran a campaign for him very nicely and got Richard Nixon elected to Congress. Then one of the first people that Richard Nixon hired on his staff in Congress was a man from Chicago named Jack Ruby from Chicago. Now all of this can be documented, and as a matter of fact, you can go to the library and read up on this in a book called George Bush by Felix Green. That's G-R-E-E-N-E. It's a book that points out that George Bush's father is credited with creating the winning ticket of Eisenhower and Nixon, and credited with creating Congressman Richard Nixon. So we've had the Bush family a long time, haven't we? And where do you suppose the Bush family is these days? Well, Jeb Bush, one of the sons of George Bush, is the head of the CIA. He's a station chief in Miami. Whoops, I'm sorry. I'm not supposed to say that in public. That's right. That's top secret state information that I can get in trouble for. The Justice Department is probably writing out a subpoena for me right now. Anyhow, Jeb Bush is the station chief for the Central Intelligence Agency. Don't tell anybody you heard this. In Miami, in charge of the Cuban community, to keep the Cuban community from talking any more than they already have, the blabbermouths, about their role in the assassination of John Kennedy. Miami is a hotbed of people that just love to talk. Frank Sturgis, who's thought to be Cuban, who's not really a Cuban, but who's an Italian CIA agent who poses as a Cuban and speaks very fluent Spanish, and at one time was part of the, by the way, as I'm making the tape, I realized today is July 26th, the anniversary of Cuba's liberation from Batista. Anyhow, Frank Sturgis was asked when he was in Miami by a television station, hey, why did you guys burglarize the Watergate anyhow? And Frank Sturgis said, and this is in the May 5th, 1977 Chronicle, well, because Nixon was interested in the assassination of President Kennedy. Huh? What did he say? Would you say that again? Why would they burglarize the Watergate? Because Nixon was interested in the assassination of John Kennedy. Well, because that's what was in the Watergate safe. The photos, the famous tramp photos, the seven famous photos, actually there's 10 of them, but only 7 of them have been released. The 10 famous tramp photos showing E. Howard Hunt and Frank Sturgis shooting President John Kennedy. That's why the Watergate burglary happened. Okay, now where's another member of the Bush family today? Well, there's a George Bush Sr. who's a banker who arranged the largest Japanese drug family. He's a representative of the largest drug family from Japan, the Japanese mafia, to purchase a large skyscraper in New York City as a safe investment, money laundry, for their ill-gotten gains. That's what George Bush Jr. is doing these days. And, of course, the other Bush, Neil Bush, was helping the CIA and the savings and loans companies rip off the United States. Henry Gonzalez, the congressman from Texas, has been saying over and over, and he's still saying it, that the savings and loan ripoff was not an accident. It was not a fluke. It was actually a CIA way to get more money for their black bag operations. Here is the essence of a story out of the Houston Post, Houston, Texas. The Post said its investigation had uncovered numerous links between organized crime figures and the Central Intelligence Agency operatives, including some involvement in gun running, drug smuggling, money laundering, and covert aid to the Nicaraguan Contra rebels. The newspaper reported that the CIA effort to raise money for covert operations had involved a number of schemes to siphon funds from 22 thrifts that had eventually failed at the expense of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. The newspaper also reported that the CIA had intervened in criminal investigations of the savings and loan crisis. Chairman of the House panel overseeing financial institutions had asked the House Intelligence Committee to investigate alleged links between the CIA and several failed thrifts. Representative Frank Annunzo, Democrat of Illinois, said Thursday that former Justice Department prosecutor had told a House Banking Subcommittee members that while looking into a thrift failure, he was told by an FBI agent to drop the investigation of one of the individuals concerned with the bank's failure because that individual had CIA connections. The prosecutor was told that the individual involved had a, quote, get out of jail free card. Annunzo said in a letter to Representative Anthony Balinson, Democrat of Los Angeles, chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Annunzo declined to identify the prosecutor. Lloyd Monroe, a Brown University researcher who prosecuted bank fraud cases as a member of the Justice Department Organized Crime Task Force, was quoted by the Houston Post last month saying he believed the CIA had masterminded or condoned some of the savings and loan fraud. The Houston Post, in a series of articles, alleged that the CIA was deeply involved in fraud to help fund its covert operations that Congress was refusing to fund. Annunzo said that during his panel's preliminary inquiry, staff members had interviewed an FBI agent who said the former prosecutor's comments to the subcommittee were correct. I do not think a well-respected former Justice Department prosecutor and a former FBI agent would make up something so serious as the CIA charges, Representative Annunzo said. Annunzo said he was at first skeptical of the reported CIA involvement, but had become convinced that at least some of the allegations have strong validity. A House spokesman for the House Intelligence Committee could not be reached for comment on whether the panel would conduct an inquiry. The Houston Post said its investigation had uncovered numerous links between organized crime figures and CIA operatives, including some involved in gun running, drug smuggling, and money laundering, and covert aid to the Contras. And with that happy note, this has been Paul Kangas, your host on KPOO Reality Sandwich, thanking you for listening. And keep those cards and letters coming, folks. The address again is P.O. Box 422-644, San Francisco 94142. That's P.O. Box 422-644, San Francisco. Phone number 897-0153. Adios. See you next week, same time, same place. And let's keep laughing. Humor is one way we can jail Bush for the murder of John Kennedy, jail Nixon, especially if Bush loses this election. But my bet is he'll actually win this election.